years ago.
I wondered, and I obviously want to be mindful of your time. I want to go back to the very beginning and understand how you first got interested in baseball. I know you were born in 1929. You were born in Brooklyn. And I wondered if you could pick up and tell me what your first connection to baseball was.
Well, I was the fourth of what became five boys. And my father was a baseball fan. He was a Giants fan. My oldest brothers, except for one. One was not a baseball fan, which I couldn't understand as a kid, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, following it because two of my brothers did and my father did. And you have to be aware that growing up in the 1930s as a baseball fan in New York, and we lived in Long Island, I was months after I was born in Brooklyn, I sat up in the crib and looked around and said, I don't want to live in Brooklyn. So the family moved. And we lived in Long Island, about 30 miles out of New York City. Mm. So we weren't right in the city. And there were three teams, of course, the Dodgers, the Yankees, and the Giants. And you were one of the three as a fan. Mm-hmm. And so, as I say, they were Giants fans. And I wasn't old enough to go to the ball grounds with them to the games when I was 3, 4 years old. When I got to be 5 years old, I was nagging a little bit. Can I go? And of course there were no night games and there were no radio broadcasts. Mm-hmm. And television was still years away. So the only way to follow the games were in the newspapers. Mm-hmm. And I started devouring them, which ones we took, or my father brought home, because he would commute and work in New York City. And on the radio, every evening, there were several 15-minute broadcasts who would broadcast news of the games and the scores and recreate the scoring highlights of the games that had been played that afternoon. Mm-hmm. And only the World Series was on radio. And we could listen to that. And so by the time I was 6, 1935, I began to get to go along to the Giants games.
And that was your first game, was when you were 1935?
Yeah, at the ball grounds. Mm-hmm. And my father, he would take us on Sundays, and it was usually a doubleheader on Sundays, and he would drive us into New York. And he would get us box seats, which probably cost $1.10 in those days. The bleachers were 25 cents. The general admission was, I think, 55 cents. And the box seats were $1.10. Mm-hmm. And in those days, general admission, the tickets didn't have seats on them. You could sit anywhere, mm-hmm, outside of the box seats. Anywhere in the whole ballpark you wanted to, outside of the box seats, for the general admission. And so we went Sundays and holidays. Holidays were always doubleheaders also. Mm-hmm. And always mobbed. Just mobbed. And I remember one year we went and it was just mobbed and there was no place to park. And we turned around and we drove over to Brooklyn because the Dodgers were playing the same day. And it's a holiday doubleheader, and the Dodgers ballpark was a whole lot smaller, and you couldn't even get near the place. Mm-hmm. So we wound up going to no game that day. Mm-hmm. So later on, my brothers and I, and my oldest brother particularly, and I, we would take the Long Island Railroad into New York City, take the subway from the railroad station up to Yankee Stadium, up to the Polo Grounds, and go for a doubleheader. And they started, the game started at 1 o'clock, and the two games were probably over by 6:30. And then we'd reverse with the subway and the train, and it would be a day that would start out at 9:30 in the morning, and we'd get home 8:30 at night. And then this was the day at the ballpark. And in 1937, the Yankees and the Giants played in the World Series in 36 and 37. And in 37, the Yankees just demolished the Giants. Mm-hmm. And I think they scored something like 7 runs or something in the 9th inning of one of the games. And I hadn't paid any attention to the American League. We were giant National League fans. And National League fans didn't pay any attention to the American League. And we hated Brooklyn, so we wouldn't go near there. And it dawned on me. And I said to myself, here I'm 8 years old, who are these guys? Mm-hmm. These monsters. They were annihilators. And I started reading about them and studying about them. And became a Yankee fan. Mm-hmm. And then they won again in 38, and they won in 39, and Lou Gehrig became my hero. Mm-hmm. And then he had to quit in 39, and I remember bawling when he died. Mm-hmm.
So you saw Lou Gehrig play?
I saw Lou Gehrig play, and I may be the only person who was there, who saw Lou Gehrig play, and was there when Cal Ripken broke his record.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What do you recall about seeing Gehrig play? Obviously, you would have been only 10 when his career ended.
So I didn't really, you know, I don't remember much about seeing him play. By 1939, we had broadcasts of games in New York. But of course, he quit on May 1st, so he wasn't playing much even in 39. Mm-hmm. But there was something about him and his story. Mm-hmm. And by now, by I guess when I was 7, 8, 9, I began to read, these books were coming out on team histories, and they were not big books. And remember, in those days, team histories weren't that long as they are today.
Yeah.
So there wasn't that much team history to write about, but they were very informal books, not full of stats or anything, but very kind of breezy style, and they were written by beat writers of the time, some of whom knew the team practically from their beginning, knew the front office people, knew the business end of it, so it was easy for them to write it. Mm-hmm. And biographies of, up to that time, of Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio appeared. Mm-hmm. And they were slim. They were small. And by now I'm reading, and so for my birthdays, family members began to give me baseball books. Mm-hmm. And one of the first one was the Lou Gehrig story. Mm. And another one was the Joe DiMaggio story. And so I had them, and I was reading them, so that's how I began to learn about more about the players. And I was was reading the newspapers and reading about them. And learned about the sporting news. So I began to get the sporting news. And it was a tremendous paper in those days. Mm-hmm. Just tremendous. I mean, the more modern, much later years of sporting, it wasn't anywhere near what it was when it was baseball only and covered everything, past, present, everything. It was tremendous. And I used to get Baseball Magazine mm-hmm. also, which was great for learning about the past. Just tremendous. So I had those resources and once you're hooked on them, you're hooked.
That's right.
But I had such great bait, which today's resources I don't think can compare to learning the game as a youth and learning the history of it and to learning all about it, all aspects of it. There's nothing today.
Now, you had aspirations to be a pitcher yourself at some point around this
time.
Yeah,
because I learned early in sandlot ball. I wasn't much of a hitter. Mm-hmm. And so I started pitching, and I got beamed once in a sandlot game, and that probably contributed something to it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I aspired to be a pitcher, and I had a garage growing up with a slanty roof, and like millions of kids, with a tennis ball, I would play a ball game by myself and throw it up on the roof and try to catch it. And this was out, and if it went past me, as far it was a single and a double, home run. You make up games and you keep scoring all. And years later, when I got to know Rex Barney and wrote a couple books with him, his biography, and he talked about doing the same kind of thing. He called it stoop ball. When he was growing up, and we were about the same age, and he's growing up in Omaha, Nebraska, and his house had three or four steps leading up to the walkway, and he's throwing the ball against those steps, and he's playing the same game I am with the same single, double, triple home run, keeping score with the two teams and all this stuff. And in the summertime, after school was out, we would go down to a house in Maryland, about 8 miles from a town called Cambridge. And there was an Eastern Shore League, and there were two teams we would go to games. One was in Federalsburg, which was an A's farm team, and another was in a town called Cambridge, which was a Dodgers farm team, Class D. Mm-hmm. In those days, the classes went down to E to D. And it was the lowest rung. And so we would go to games there, and they were all night games. And the Dodgers had a tryout camp there. So I was used to throwing to my brothers and just for kicks, excuse me, I'm 15 years old. And I thought, well, I'll go. Uh-huh. They have a uniform, no shoes or nothing like that. So I took my mitt, and I hitchhiked, I think it was about 8 miles, to this town, to the tryout camp. And I don't remember how many kids were there, but they stick a number on your back, and what position do you play, and I said, pitcher. And I fooled around, I had been fooling around with what we call a drop ball, mm-hmm. and a little itty bitty nickel curve and stuff like that. And I couldn't throw hard. I really wasn't hard. I was a skinny little kid. But the scout, Rex Bowen, his name was, old time scout. So you take a turn pitching. So you warm up, and then one inning starts, and he said, okay, kid. So I go out to the mound and start pitching, and I'm throwing this junk. And got one guy out, got the second guy out, and I guess they saw that that's all I had, because after that it was bing, 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 and they started hitting it. So I pitched two-thirds of an inning, and then they were just hitting it. So the scout took me out, and he said, kid, you just don't throw hard enough. If you learn, or if you can throw hard, he said, that we can teach you everything else, but we can't teach you how to throw hard. You haven't got it. Go back, grow up, see if you can throw harder, come back when you can throw hard. So.
Did you come back?
I never threw hard. I used to, when I went to college, I hung around.
At the University of Chicago.
The University of Chicago. I hung around the baseball team, and the coach let me throw a little to guys, and I caught pitchers warming up, and I never got in a game or anything. It was wartime. They were all older guys. I was, that's a whole other story, but I was 15, and these guys are 18, 19, 20 years old. So I know I wasn't making any
big
team,
difference, yeah.
But he let me hang around and do that much. And I got to throw some, but it wasn't coming. So,
did you have a sense of what your next steps in baseball would be at this time? I know obviously you got an apprenticeship with the Atlanta Crackers.
Well, that came through Ernie Harwell, which is a whole other story. I wanted to do something in baseball. I wasn't going to be a player. I gave that up. So I thought maybe front office, the business end of it. But I really didn't know. But my brother, who was going to Georgia Tech at the time, was an equipment manager for the Georgia Tech football team. And Ernie Harwell was a broadcaster for WSB in Atlanta. And he would go out looking for Georgia Tech football players, or in season basketball or baseball players, to interview for his sports program. And so he met my brother and asked him sometimes to help to see who would be a good interview and to ask the players there. And so they became friends. They were about the same age. Ernie was going to, I think, Emory University at the time. So they became friends. They both went into service. About same time. The war ended while I was still in Chicago. Ernie went back to Atlanta, began broadcasting the Atlanta Crackers Southern Association games. My brother went back to finish at Georgia Tech. So they picked up again where they left off and were great friends and were now both married. So they became, their couples were friends. So when I graduated, I was thinking, gee, maybe I could go down to Atlanta. And my brother arranged for me to, if I went down there, to meet Ernie. And Ernie agreed to see what he could do to help me, because by now he's working with the Atlanta Crackers. So I went down there in 48, before the season, and Ernie agreed to hire me as a statistician for him and to help him in the broadcast booth, like a gopher. I would get the lineups from the Crackers and the other team before the game. I would ask questions if Ernie wanted to find anything. He liked to keep the batting averages up to date during the game. So each time a player batted, I would update the batting average for him. I had a little booklet for instant calculation of batting averages. One down page, one column would have number at bats, other column would have number of hits. So I could look up, I didn't have to figure it out and forget calculators. I mean, we're talking about 1948, so I could keep it up for him. I could keep, there was a ticker for scores of other games going on, things like that. So I helped him, and he got me a job as a copywriter, writing ad copy and stuff like that, for the radio station that carried the games. So I worked there as well as for him. Because all our games except Sundays were night games. So I could work during the day at the radio station and then go, it wasn't very far, to go out to Ponsilian Ballpark and work from. And the road games, we did by ticker tape in the, at the radio station. So I was right there. So that's what I did in 48. And in 48 is when he went up to Brooklyn, midway through the season. And he had, another one of my jobs was that he had made his own thing that held, a wooden thing that held the scorecard, his own kind of invention, with the whole roster and room for the lineup and a fielding diagram for each team that he's broadcasting the game. And he had a card. He had flaps on each side with a card with each player on each team in the league. So there's eight teams. And in spring training, he would get information from each team on each player. But in addition to that, when they first came into Atlanta, he had He interviewed the players and got personal information. What were their hobbies, what they do during the off season, where they went to school, all kind of stuff he hadn't already gotten from the team. So that when these guys came up to bat, he had all this background information, he flipped the card to that player, and he could talk about it. He could talk
about
it.
Great innovation.
So-and-so was a real hotshot at Albany, Georgia High School. He was the class president, and he also hit 600 in his senior year in high school, whatever. And he had all this information, but he wanted to keep it up to date, so I was the one to go up to these players and ask these questions to get the information for them and to keep these cards up to date. So now it's 48, and incidentally, he had a bad case of appendicitis during that year before he went up to Brooklyn. So he gets this promotion where he's going to go up to Brooklyn, and it's the middle of the season, and he said to me, I need a card file on every player in the National League. I want you to make them up for me. I said, how long do I have? He said, 2 weeks.
For every player.
Because he's going to go up there in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
He had in his home a library, a room lined with bookshelves and books. He had file cabinets with clippings that he had kept. And I mean, he was an original historian. He had baseball guys, all kinds of stuff in there. And he said, you go to the house. I knew his family, his kids and his wife. You go stay there. Live there. Sleep there. Use all the resources that I have and type up those cards for me. So I did.
That's quite a good education.
So I did. So I saw all this stuff and I saw all this research information. And of course I'm living in a rooming house. I mean, I don't have any room to put that kind of stuff. But I saw what a research collection was and what kind of material there was for research, and where it had come from, and all the newspaper clipping and stuff. There was no, he didn't have any microfilm reader or anything. And so I did it, and I said to him, that was a cruel thing to do, because how much sleep do you think I got? I was sleeping in that room. I said, well, all these books to read, to look at, and I'm going to sleep in this room. I'm not getting enough sleep because I'm reading your books and looking at all your books. So I said, I can't pay you much. And he said, so I said, okay, what I want from you is 3 of your books from your collection here as payment. So he said, okay, these are the books you can't choose, but any one of the others, you choose 3 books. So there were 3. One was a sports encyclopedia, and the other 2 were history books. I don't remember all the titles now. But they were the kind of books that I hadn't seen before. So I picked those 3 books, and I had them the rest of my life. So I had to get rid of all my books. You don't see many here, because all my books I had to get rid of, because when we moved from Texas to here, it was unexpected. It was knowing that I wouldn't have room for all those books, and I had to do something in a hurry. So I wound up at SMU had a separate sports library, and they were willing, they wanted to take them. And they could take them, the guy from the library drove a van, his own van, to my house, which was a couple hours away, to take everything. Because it was all my files, all my, kind of my research material, everything. All my tapes of all my interviews.
All went everything. Yeah.
Everything went. He took it all. And that's where it all is. And my interview tapes, they're copying. They digitized them. And they've agreed. They said it'll take some time, but they've agreed. And I put them in touch with Jacob Pomerenke. They've agreed to make copies of them to send to add to the oral history collection. So eventually, they'll all get to, in addition to the ones that I sent directly to the oral history collection, they'll eventually all get there.
So by now, you have become someone who knew you loved baseball research. But at the same time, you were also doing front office work. Did you have a sense of which way things were going to turn at this time?
I was working, so I got a job with the Atlanta Crackers after Ernie left. I continued to work for his successors on the broadcast, but I worked in the front office learning the business from the Atlanta Crackers. And Earl Mann, who ran the Crackers, who was the owner, had been there for a long time. And he said to me, I had met him as a result of working with Ernie, he said to me, I don't really need you, but you can sit here, work in the front office, answer the phone, ask any questions you want, help out the secretary, the full-time employee, the concessions manager, the full-time employee, the groundskeeper, learn whatever you can from them and do whatever they ask you to help in some way. So that's what I did the rest of 48 and all of 49. And that was great. That was great. And at the same time, as I say, working on the radio broadcast. So, I mean, I loved it. I loved it. And in, I was there in 49 and 50. And then I heard about an opening for the business manager slash general manager for the Valley Rebels in Lynette, Alabama, which was right on the Georgia-Alabama line. I don't know, 50, 60 miles south of Atlanta, Georgia, Alabama, Class D. And I went down, interviewed. It was seasonal only, not year round. The team was owned by the Valley was a Valley, they consist of six little towns, five or six. It was all textile mills. Every town. The industry was a textile mill. And they owned the franchise. They ran the franchise. And so I was it. It was a one-man job. An old man as a groundskeeper, But otherwise, I did everything.
Mm.
I ran the concessions, ran the ticket sales. I was married that year, so my wife sold scorecards. And I did the selling of the scorecards, I did the promotion in the town. That was it. It was a one-man job.
Mm-hmm.
But you earned. You earned everything. And I loved it.
But since it was seasonal, you also had to think about other things.
Yeah, and I think it paid, I don't know, I forget now, $50 a week? It wasn't much, but it was enough. And we rented the second floor of a house in the Georgia side of the river. And yeah, when the season was over, the job was over. And but it just happened that at that time, the Korean War started, the draft started, and my draft number came up. And at the time, they were drafting people into the Marines. They'd never done that before, and they never did that after. But they were drafting guys directly into the Marines. And in 6 weeks, you were liable to be over in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason that I can't recall now, that did not appeal to me. So I enlisted in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And took the physical and all that stuff, and was to report January 2nd. So I didn't even have time to think about, what do I do next? It was already thought about for me. So that ended. What was I going to do next for the next 4 years? Which actually the war ended in that time, and we got out a little bit early, but that took care of that. So then I, when I got out, I went to Florida Southern University in Florida, in Lakeland. They had a school, I think it was a 6 week school, for baseball front office. And they had working general managers taking turns doing the teaching. Different aspects of it. So I went to the Air Force and I said, this school starts, I forget, I think it was December, end of December, sometime like that. I want an early discharge, early enough, so I can go to this school. So they agreed. I got out in December and drove down, took my wife and my mother, and we drove down to Lakeland where I went to this school. And I thought it was good. It's a good school. And then I went from there to the winter meetings, baseball meetings. Try and get a job. And I interviewed with a couple farm directors and some minor league guys who ran minor league clubs who were there. And I remember I made an appointment to meet with Branch Rickey Jr.,
mm-hmm.
who was running
yeah.
farms.
Who's still involved in it,
not Branch Rickey Jr.
Oh, Branch, the third, I'm sorry. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's Branch Rickey Jr. And he told me, one of the things I remember he told me was, I could interview you, and I told him a little bit about myself. He said, if you talk to my father, one thing you have to remember is he hires more people in conversation than he's actually going to use, than he can actually use. And I never did interview with Branch Rickey, with Senior. But I did meet the farm director for the Milwaukee Braves.
Uh-huh.
And he said, we have two openings. One is in Idaho Falls, and one is in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Well, all I'd ever known was the East Coast. And so I remember I called my wife and I said, they have openings in these two places. Which one would you rather go to? We didn't know anybody, either one. But I figured that, well, Eau Claire, Wisconsin is closer to Milwaukee than Idaho Falls. So maybe I would have a better chance to become better known by the guys in Milwaukee who are running things if I'm in Eau Claire. So that pretty much was the basis.
And you went there for 1 year?
Actually, I was in Eau Claire 2 years.
2 years?
Yeah.
And then you, after that, you went to Knoxville.
I was in Knoxville. Of course, after my first year at Eau Claire, I said to them, gee, I'd like to go with you to the winter meeting, which were in, that year was in Jacksonville, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a train ride. And I said, I would like to go with you. And they said, well, we'll pay for you to go if you promise that you're not going there to look for another job.
Mm-hmm.
Which is understandable, because they're taking me. So I said, okay, I promise. I'll come back to Eau Claire for a second year.
Mm-hmm.
So they took me. And I went to the major league meetings, and I enjoyed it. And I did meet people there. And that's where I met the guys from Knoxville.
Uh-huh.
And I told, and they were interested in me. And I told them, well, I promised the Milwaukee people that I would go back to Eau Claire in exchange for their taking me to this meeting. So I'm going back to Eau Claire for a second year.
Uh-huh.
And they said, we respect that. After that year, contact us again. So that's what happened. So I went back to Eau Claire for the second year.
Uh-huh.
And then I contacted the Knoxville people, and they were in the Sally League. And Bill Terry was the president of the Sally League. And that's where I met Bill Terry, the Hall of Famer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so that was Class A So I figured, well, that's a promotion. And that's where I went.
Mm-hmm.
And
so at what point did you think of becoming a stockbroker? Because I know that the television market was growing and the minor league opportunities were shrinking.
Yes, they were. They certainly were. While I was in Eau Claire, I would... I got to know the stockbroker there, and I would occasionally stop in at their office. But I wasn't an active investor or anything. But then in Knoxville, I got to know the guys there. And Knoxville did not last the whole season. I got laid off because, as you say, the minor leagues were struggling. They were a locally, a civically owned team, and they had their board of directors there, and they were losing money, and they had to find a way to cut expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And I was expendable. And they had a volunteer who had been there for a long time, who was, in a sense, acting as my assistant. And he told them that he could do my job in addition to what he was doing. He was helping mainly with the concessions and that kind of stuff. But as a farm team of Baltimore at the time, they had nothing to do with the players at all. Now, let me back up a minute. That first year, when I was with the Valley Rebels, they were an independent team. We had to sign our own players or ask some farm systems to send us players, but we didn't own them, just to farm them out to us. But otherwise, we were an independent team. We had to find our own manager and our own players. And so that's how we operated. So there was a little more to it, because we had to do all our own paperwork. But with Eau Claire, Milwaukee, they sent us the players. And the same in Knoxville. We didn't have anything to do with that part of it. So they let me go before the season ended. So I stayed down there a while, and that's how I began to spend some time in the stockbroker's office.
Uh-huh.
And two things that happened over the years. Number one, as you say, the minor leagues were shrinking, and the openings were becoming fewer and fewer. And number two was that personally, I had now seen that a promotion in the minor leagues meant a move. And I had already moved from Atlanta to the Valley Rebels, and I had already moved around, or been moved, during 4 years in the service, and then I had then moved back to New York temporarily, then to Wisconsin for the 2 years, then to Knoxville for a year, and it was beginning to get old. And I figured, okay, if I stay in this line of work, it's going to mean more moving.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't think, number one, it was going to be fair to my wife, because it always meant an apartment. It was likely to be for a short time each year.
Uh-huh.
I had no idea of when or if we would land in some front office, major league front office.
Uh-huh.
So that kind of...
Now, were you thinking about doing baseball writing at that time? I know eventually freelance baseball writing became an avenue to stay involved with the game without all of the travel.
Yeah. Actually, I thought of that before. Because while I was in service, that one year I was, or I think it was a little over a year, I was stationed just outside of St. Louis, at Scottsfield, Illinois. And living in St. Louis. And while I was there, my job was to be the sports editor of the base newspaper at Scottsfield, which was a pretty easy job. So I went one year to Sportsman's Park. I went one day to Sportsman's Park. Bill Veeck was the owner of the Browns. And here I am, I'm in uniform, and I went to interview him. I'm in uniform. And I told him, I said, I write this column for the Scottsfield Air Force Base newspaper. So I went to interview him. He was very gracious while I was talking to him. Freddie Hutchinson, his manager, popped in to ask him about something. He introduced me, and we talked a little bit. But then Hutchinson left, and I was asking him about what he suggested a person study and how he suggested a person prepare himself to find a job in the front office, baseball front office.
Huh.
And he told me, I remember one of the things he said is, one thing that's going to help you is learn to write shorthand, because you're going to sit in a lot of meetings, and to be able to take notes like that, you're going to find it's very helpful. That's one thing I remember that he said. So anyhow, he offered me a pass to Sportsman's Park, a press pass, because the Browns own Sportsman's Park. Both the Browns and the Cardinals games.
Mm.
So I used that, particularly for the night games, while I was there that season.
Mm.
At Sporting Park. It gave me access to sitting in the dugout before the game.
Yep.
And sitting in the press box during the game. And that was it was quite different. Then, in 54, from what it is today. So I'm stationed there, and while I'm there, I went down to the Sporting News, which is located downtown St. Louis.
Uh-huh.
And I went in and introduced myself to J.G. Taylor Spink. And I said to him, let me back up a minute. While I was with the Valley Rebels, the Sporting News had pages of notes of items from each class of baseball. Mm-hmm. Class B, all the leagues, Class B, Class C, Class D. So I would send him notes. For example, I wanted to set a record for attendance at a game, at a Class D game, but I didn't know what the record was. Mm-hmm. So I sent this note in, and he ran the note in the Sporting News.
Ah.
So we were trying to find out. I had a little section right behind third base. Bleachers, there were bleachers. I got a photo in there at the old ballpark, but it was really a primitive ballpark, Class D wooden ballpark of its time. And I had this little section that was maybe too deep. It wasn't wide, seated maybe, I don't know, six across of a, maybe two bleachers, and then standing room, and a telephone pole, electric pole, the big wooden ones of the time, were sitting there, and I had called that little section the jury box for the most regular, loudest fans. And I called it the jury box, and I put a sign up. It said jury box.
Oh.
And one day, George Troutman, who was the commissioner of the National League, of the minor leagues, of all the minor leagues, was making a tour, and he came to a game at our ballpark. So I had the local newspaper take a picture of George Troutman. He wanted to sit in the jury box. So I had the paper take a picture of him sitting in the jury box. And they ran it in the local paper, but we sent it to the Sporting News, and they ran it. So I've got a clipping of what ran the Sporting News. So now I'm stationed in St. Louis. And I go in to see Spink, and I remind him of these things that I had sent him from there. And I said, I would like to work for you. See, I'm thinking also, well, maybe baseball writing. And he said, well, you come and see me after when you get out of the service. So while I'm in service, I went from there, they moved me to Portland, Oregon. And my job was involved traveling around the whole state, which I did. And I noticed that Larry Jansen, the old Giants pitcher, was living in Oregon. So I thought, well, I'll go see him. So I went to see him, did an interview with him, which was not great, and didn't have much with me. Didn't have much preparation. But I did the interview with him, wrote it up, sent it to the Sporting News. He sent me a check for $25 for it. He never ran it. Now, I guess it was just out of the goodness of the heart or whatever that he sent me the check. I don't know whether I ever intended to run it, but he never ran it. But anyhow, it was the first article that I ever sold, the first baseball article I ever sold. So then after I got out of the service, as I said, I went to that baseball school, and then I continued in the front office. So I wasn't doing any writing at that time.
Did you think you could make a living doing baseball writing? I mean, you're getting $25 for an article.
No, which was mainly why I went back to pursue the front office when I got out of the service. Mm-hmm. And then I became a stockbroker partly because it looked interesting, because it involved research of a kind, and because I liked the hours.
Yeah.
The hours were short, and so I liked that part of it. And it was something that you could do most anywhere.
Now, did meeting Larry Jansen, even if you said the interview wasn't particularly good, did it sort of open a door for you to things like Dick Bartel later, or Rex Barney, and sort of saying, hey, I enjoy hearing their stories, and piecing things together?
Yeah, and I wasn't particularly writing them when I would go to see and talk to a player. It wasn't in the beginning so much to make an article out of something, mm-hmm. as just to meet them and talk to them.
And record their, I assume you recorded these, right? So.
Well, in the very beginning, it was, I'm trying to think now of the sequence of how that started. Because when I began as a broker, it was in New York City where I went as a trainee, so I wasn't really doing it much then. Mm-hmm. Then I moved to Florida. I chose to go to Florida to work as a broker for the firm where I had trained. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Florida, and that's where we established to stay to live. Mm-hmm. And eventually built a house there. But I was a broker, I was not doing anything in baseball. Mm-hmm. And that took a while. And actually my writing came in then, not for baseball, but I got involved in local politics. Mm-hmm. And the local school board and the local taxpayers association. And I began to write an uncompensated weekly column just about local politics, that mm-hmm. sort of thing, in Miami Beach, which is where we wound up. For a Miami Beach newspaper. Which was independent, just a local paper. And it was a giveaway type of paper. But it was a good paper, and it was, and I enjoyed it, and I could write about anything I wanted. It could be personal, it didn't even have to be political. And that from there, so I got involved in that. Mm-hmm.
So you were not doing much baseball writing from in the 60s or 70s?
No, I wasn't. And I'm trying to think now. When I got into it.
The impression I have was that when you connected with Dick Bartel was when it really sort of...
Yeah, it was when I moved to California. Well, I joined Sabre in 85.
86 is what I had read.
86.
Yeah.
I thought it was 85. When they had a convention in Providence is when I first heard of it.
Okay.
Because I was living right next to the Rhode Island border.
Ah, okay. So Sabre had been around by that time for close to 15 years.
Whenever the convention was in Providence.
Okay. We'll see if I can find out.
That's... I know it was in the 80s.
So certainly in the mid-80s, you had... was by the time you had... okay, the Providence Convention was the 14th ever Sabre Convention, it says. And so that would have been 1984 was when that conference was held.
Okay, that's when I heard of it.
Okay.
And so I think... Luke
Gorman was the keynote speaker.
So it was 85. I just heard of it. I didn't go.
Okay.
Because I was living right near Providence, that I saw this article about this convention, and I had never heard of it before that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I joined, was hearing about it. So that's why I think it was 85 when I first joined. But Sabre knows. And so that's when I started going to meetings in Providence.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had meetings in Central Connecticut. And I went to them. And then they had meetings in Boston. And I wasn't that far from Boston. I was right in the very corner where Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut come together. So I went to ones in Boston.
Ah, okay.
So that's how I began to see these players at the meetings and get interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
But
the Sabre was relatively small at that time, certainly compared to the way it is today.
Yeah.
But was it primarily researchers who were interested in the early century?
I don't remember. I don't remember now what most of the publications consisted of.
Okay.
I don't know whether it was...
My sense was that it was 20s and 30s baseball primarily.
That I don't remember.
So it was around the time you joined Sabre?
I knew, and I don't remember just when, but I know I started sending them articles.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that was the time when we had a printed bulletin that came out.
Right.
I don't know if it was every month or not.
I think it was every month.
Yeah. But we didn't have, you know, this.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't remember the first article that I sent them.
At what point did you make contact with Dick Bartel to start? Because that book was published in 87, so it had to have been somewhere around that time.
I was... I spent 2 years in England. 73. Three and 74.
Okay.
And that's when I wound up in Northern California in 74. And knew I was gonna, or figured I was gonna be there a while. I had no idea how long. And that's when I began to to look for ballplayers. I knew that Bartel, I knew as a Giants fan.
Yeah, growing up.
In 35, 36, 37. Yeah. So somehow I learned, I guess, that Bartel was living in Alameda, which is right across from San Francisco. And I'm in Santa Rosa, which is maybe, I don't know, 30-some miles, maybe a little more, from San Francisco. So I go there, and I ring his doorbell, and I introduce myself, and I told him that I remember seeing him as a Giants fan way back then. I would like to write an article about him. I remember saying that to him. And he says, well, he was a real cocky little guy, real bantamweight little guy. He said, I'd like to write a book about my baseball career. So I said, okay, let's write a book.
Like you're standing on the front step?
Yeah. And I'd never written a book. I never thought about writing a book before. But I just said it. So he said, come on in. So we talked about it. And I said, well, I think the first thing we have to do is find an agent who can find a publisher for us. I said, I think that's the way it works. That you don't want to write the book until you have a publisher who wants it. I said, let's start that way. So I start contacting, I look up in the Writer's Digest, I think, they have a section.
Okay. The book where you look for publishers.
For publishers and for agents.
For agents, okay.
So I look up agents in New York. I figure, gee, he played his best years in New York. True, it was a while ago, but let's start with that. So I did. And I made my pitch to some of them, and I talked about Bartel with his pennant winners and so forth, and he had a great career, and he played this long. And Giants fans from the 30s and 40s are going to remember him. But this is now the 70s, late 70s. And some of them said, it's too far back. And I remember a couple of them said, bring me any New York player now, or recent, I don't care who he is. Doesn't have to be a Hall of Famer or a great. I can sell it. Well, I didn't know any current New York players. And Bartel is the one who says, let's do a book. So Bartel is the one I'm trying to sell. So anyhow, this is the kind of response I was getting. That it's too far back. Nobody apparently was thinking baseball history then, like today. I mean, now this is 40 years ago. So I was striking out. I wasn't getting anywhere. So somehow, I don't remember how now, I came upon a publisher in Berkeley, California, who had published a baseball book, but that was not his primary thing. His primary thing had to do with spiritual kind of stuff. But anyhow, okay, he's in Berkeley, so I'm here. So I went to see him, and I told him about a book, and it turned out that he was a baseball fan. So I told him about Bartell, and who was certainly before his time. I told him how he lived right there in Alameda, right next to Berkeley. And he said, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. He liked the idea. He looked up Bartell, and he looked up, and I told him what a colorful person he was. And we decided to make it National League Baseball of the 1930s.